Good day, Trinidad, Tobago, Caribbean, and the world. Welcome to this week's edition of Strictly Legal on WESN Contents Capital. I am your host, Rondell Donohue, attorney at law. Once again, I'm happy to bring the law and you. Of course, you can stream us on WESN social media platforms, including the World Wide Web, and of course, Strictly Legal with RondellDonohue.com podcast. So we are going internationally. Today we are going to speak about international law. As you would have known, we are in interesting times with respect to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. Now, in the early morning hours of the 24th of February 2022, the Russian Federation declared what President Vladimir Putin called a special military operation against Ukraine. The stated purpose of the special military operation, according to President Putin, is to stop a genocide of millions of people who live in Luhansk and Donetsk Oblast of Ukraine. Specifically, the president of the Russian Federation asserted that the purpose of this operation is to protect people who for 8 years now have been facing humiliation and genocide perpetrated by the Kiev regime. Of course, the Russian Federation asserted that it intends to denazify Ukraine and bring to trial those who perpetrated numerous bloody crimes against civilians. And on that basis, these claims of genocide, the Russian Federation immediately commenced an unprovoked invasion throughout Ukrainian territory, which is already causing catastrophic harms to Ukraine and its people, both military and civilian. Let's take a look.
Major breaking news this hour as Ukrainian government leaders say the Russian invasion has begun.
He's calling it a peacekeeping mission.
But NATO expansion and its use of Ukraine's territory has become unacceptable to Russia.
This is plainly in breach of international law.
As President Vladimir Putin ordered Russian troops into eastern Ukraine, Western sanctions were issued in response.
Volunteers queue for hours to sign up to fight for their country.
Well, tens of thousands of foreigners are helping the Ukrainian fight.
Nearly 3 million refugees have fled Ukraine since the war started.
Officials from both sides continue to talk, looking for a negotiated settlement. The Kremlin said the discussions were positive. But neither side says where the progress is being made.
Now, Ukraine filed an application with the International Court of Justice, which is known as the World Court, on the 25th of February 2022, instituting proceedings against the Russian Federation in a dispute concerning the interpretation, application, or fulfillment of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Now, Ukraine requested that the president of the court call upon the Russian Federation to immediately halt all military actions in Ukraine pending the holding of a hearing to enable an order of the court that may make a request for what you call provisional measures to have effects. Now, the International Court of Justice is what you call a principal judicial organ of the United Nations. And these courts comprise of 15 judges who are selected by the General Assembly. And the seat of the court is at the Peace Palace in The Hague, which is called the World Court. Now, on the 16th of March 2022, which was just yesterday, President Donohue of the court made certain provisional orders against Russia. Let's take a look.
The court reaffirms that its orders on provisional measures under Article 41 of the statute have binding effect and thus create international legal obligations for any party to whom the provisional measures are addressed. For these reasons, the court indicates the following provisional measures. By 13 votes to 2, the Russian Federation shall immediately suspend the military operations that it commenced on 24 February 2022 in the territory of Ukraine. By 13 votes to 2, the Russian Federation shall ensure that any military or irregular armed units which may be directed or supported by it, as well as any organizations and persons which may be subject to its control or direction, take no steps in furtherance of the military operations referred to in point one above. 3, unanimously, both parties shall refrain from any action which may aggravate or extend the dispute before the court or make it more difficult to resolve.
And with me, of course, I do have an international guest. His name is Mr. Anand Biharilal, Queen's Counsel of No. 2 Bedford Row Chambers in London. Mr. Biharilal is no stranger to our jurisdiction, as he exercises or he practices in Trinidad and Tobago as well. And he was on a previous edition of Strictly Legal speaking about the Privy Council. So I'm very pleased to introduce to you once again from the UK, currently in his chambers, Anand Biharilal. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Rondell. How are you?
I'm good. Well, it's afternoon by you, so I was sick of the afternoon as well.
No, that's all right. That's all right. Let's stick with the morning. I think that's most of the people looking.
Indeed. So thanks for coming back on to us. I'm sure persons who are viewing are very appreciative.
Not at all. Right, my pleasure. Indeed. And always good to be back with St. Benedict's alumni.
Of course. Most importantly. So let's get right into it in terms of the context of what has just been stated. Now, we have a Russian-Ukraine situation where now the Ukraine would have gone before the International Court of Justice seeking certain provisional measures. But let's talk about those measures. What exactly are those measures? Because I know the audio, there were some problems with the audio. So let's talk about those measures.
Well, to set the context, the court has not given any final determination. These are, as you described, provisional measures based on an application which was as a result of a much wider complaint. As you know, the original court, and you've summarized this, is an international court. It is a court where member states of the United Nations can petition that court for various types of declaratory relief. In this particular instance, the Ukrainian country has actually made a petition, making an application, asking for various declarations in relation to the Genocide Convention, in relation to false claims of genocide, and in relation to ceasing the actions in relation to Russia's claims, what Russia has described as a special military operation, to actually cease those actions and asking for full reparation for all damage that has been caused as a result of what the Ukrainians say are false allegations. At this point in time, I think it might be helpful just to understand that the Ukraine is a sovereign state. Mm. It's a sovereign state that was entitled to, one, exist as any sovereign state like Trinidad and Tobago, but more importantly, to petition the International Court of Justice if there is a dispute to which it says it has jurisdiction. And I understand from the judgment that the Russian Federation disputed or made arguments about jurisdiction as to whether the ICJ should get involved at this stage. And the ICJ took the view, well, actually, no, they can. And they could examine into the application that was made before it.
Now, let's pause there. And I know you indicated that Russian basically objected to whether or not the ICJ has jurisdiction. Now, can you explain to the viewers as to what is jurisdiction, and also why is it that Russia has had that that objection or that claim?
Sure. Well, the jurisdiction comes from the court itself. Various countries, including Trinidad and Tobago, have signed the various treaties that would enable it to petition that court if there is a dispute. States that are entitled to appear before the court, as I say, include the Russian Federation, which was an original member from 1945, the Ukraine, an original member again in 1945, and Trinidad and Tobago joined in its own right when it became independent in 1962. In relation to the jurisdiction of the court, the jurisdiction for the purposes of this discussion is essentially that in accordance with international law, disputes of a legal nature can be submitted by the states to the International Court of Justice. And the International Court of Justice can adjudicate on disputes submitted to it and make various orders and also give orders for provisional measures, which may be a first stage of a further judgment later on down the line when it's had an opportunity to examine all of the evidence in critical detail. Just pausing there,
yes.
In relation to evidence, you'll appreciate that the period between when the Ukraine or State of Ukraine petitioned the court on the 26th of February 2022 and the court making the orders that you've summarized for the viewers on the 16th of March 2022, just yesterday, that wouldn't have been enough time to examine all of the evidence and look at, hear all of the witnesses, look at all of the documents in relation to what is a evolving and very serious dispute.
Now, with respect to the provisional measures that the court would have sanctioned, can you just go through these provisional measures for us?
Sure. Okay. Well, what the court has done is, having considered the allegation, and we may want to talk a little bit about the allegation itself.
Yes.
The allegations made by the Ukraine were made under the allegations of genocide under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. So that's the context. The declarations that the Ukraine sought was that essentially there was no genocide taking place in the Luhansk and Donbass region of the Ukraine. They also say that there is a completely false claim being made by the Russian Federation that such genocide ever took place. You use the phrase in describing the dispute that Russia was saying its objective is to denazify.
Yes.
This part of the Ukraine. Well, the Ukraine says very clearly, look, this is a nonsense. This is absolutely false. There has been no genocide taking place in the Luhansk and Donbass regions of the Ukraine, that this is a false premise to justify the invasion. And they then sought all of those declarations and an order for full reparation of all damage caused by the Russian Federation as a consequence of that false allegation of genocide. What the court has done is that, with all of the powers available to it under the statute, it has made three orders. The first order is that the Russian Federation immediately suspend the military operations that it commenced in the territory of the Ukraine. The second is that the Russian Federation should ensure that any military or irregular armed units, and you may have seen some reports about irregular units being employed, mercenaries and so forth, and what the order covers them as well, to say that, look, the Russian Federation, with all of the control it has over these people, must take steps to stop these military operations. Okay?
Yes.
Now the third order, which is the only unanimous order, funnily enough, is that both parties are to refrain from any action which might aggravate or extend the dispute before the court or make it more difficult to resolve. And that really ties into why these are provisional measures, because the court will have a further role to play later on.
And let's look at, okay, we have the provisional measures. The court would have, at least a majority decision, decided that, well, the military action should be halted. But today we look at the news and these military actions are still there. Russia is still occupying parts of Ukraine, a significant portion. So are there sanctions? How can now the court enforce, or Ukraine enforce, these provisional measures?
I think it's very difficult to talk about enforcement and sanctions at the same time, because, as you know, sanctions have been agreed by various countries throughout the world, including as far afield as Japan, in relation to sanctioning the Russian Federation, which is essentially economic sanctions. We understand that those sanctions are having a powerful effect in Russia, which is particularly being felt by the closure of various Western-based industries and commercial ventures, oil producers, oil explorers, and also it's had an effect on the ruble, the value of the local currency in Russia. So sanctions are already in place. But in terms of actually enforcing this, the sad reality is that unless the United Nations is prepared to take steps to compel, if you like, the Russian Federation to comply with these orders, there is no meaningful way in which the Russian Federation can be compelled to comply with the provisional orders that have been made. The basis, of course, of the International Court of Justice, the basis of the United Nations is supposed to be cooperation by all nations. Indeed. And I think the difficulty here is that we can see that there is neither unanimity or a desire to cooperate. And the Russian Federation doesn't even acknowledge that this is an invasion. It has decided to call it a special military operation or words to that effect.
Now, just a question, and we're going further, maybe outside of law, that what is the real basis for the United Nations? What is the real functions of the United Nations? It seems as though it's more of a diplomatic type of peacekeeping arrangement, but whether or not the United Nations actually have teeth to do something or to invade, not invade, but at least to provide some forcible sanctions besides economic sanctions. I mean, I know there was mention about the no-fly zone, and of course that comes with certain consequences because now you're including NATO countries, and now that will that can cause a proposed World War III, as some persons are saying. So, what is all of this diplomacy about?
Well, I suppose this is the non-legal part of the discussion we're going to have. But essentially, as people may know, the Charter of the United Nations, I mean, you mentioned, you know, World War III, but we want to avoid that. That is what all of these diplomatic efforts are designed to avoid. That is why NATO does not want to send NATO-authorized aircraft into the Ukraine region, because that could pitch NATO forces against Russian forces, at least in the air. And if that were to happen, I think President Biden of America has pointed that out, that that would be World War III, because it would be NATO then versus the Russian Federation. But coming back to the United Nations was set up with a view to avoiding conflicts like this, and certainly with a view to avoiding another world war conflict. The Charter of the United Nations was signed in San Francisco in June 1945, and it's the foundational treaty of the United Nations, and it also is the treaty that brought into being the International Court of Justice. The question of what the United Nations can do has been pretty well illustrated recently by the publicized meeting of the Security Council as to whether steps could be taken by agreement to bring about an end to the fighting in Ukraine. The short answer is, unless the various council members of the United Nations Security Council come to agreement, it is not possible.
But even
to
that,
bring an end to it.
But even that, if I may stick up in, even that was met with veto powers by Russia. And I'm thinking, okay, if there's an issue involving Russia, then why is it that Russia still has the authority to exercise that veto power or not recuse themselves? And what is that veto power? Because, I mean, some may ask, okay, why is it that one state has a veto power to decide against a conflict when other countries are voting for in the Security Council?
Sure. Well, a veto power is simply a power to say, no, I will not agree with a particular course. And if that one veto is exercised, the decision, even though the decision may be supported by a majority, cannot be carried through. We have features of the veto in Trinidad and Tobago, for example. So where for example, the appointment of the Director of Public Prosecutions or the Solicitor General. There are various recommendations that might be made by the Judicial and Legal Services Commission, but the Prime Minister has a power of veto to say, well, I disagree and I'm going to reject the recommendation that is made. So the power of the veto is simply a power to say no, but it's such a powerful procedure to use because even if you have 9 people out of 10 in agreement for a particular course, the one person who exercises the power of veto can stop it.
And there are only few countries that exercise or that has that veto power within the United Nations.
Essentially, the founding members of the United Nations, which are members of important chambers like the Security Council, have that power of veto. And that is where Russia, as an important and powerful member of the Security Council, can and has exercised its power of veto.
That is very interesting indeed, and goes back to now the consequence of or the importance of international law and international relations. While international law, persons can argue that okay, you are fighting or you are trying to get to the bottom of a conflict in terms of sanctions, etc. Does international law actually work?
For the most part, Rondell, international law does work very well. It works particularly well between reciprocal member states. So, for example, Trinidad and Tobago, if you brought I use a domestic example.
Indeed.
If in Trinidad and Tobago you were to bring an action that has implications for a company or a party abroad, it is possible to enforce against that party abroad once you secure a judgment in Trinidad and Tobago and vice versa. So international law does have a domestic application, but at this particular level, Rondell, where you're dealing with military and armed conflicts, unless you have, if you like, the military conviction to enforce decisions like this, it is virtually impossible to enforce them at this level, because you're talking about a very powerful world power exercising its military might in a much smaller country. But that smaller country cannot defend itself as well as it would like, not least because that country is neither a part of NATO or part of the European Union. And I should point out that had Ukraine, as it had wished to do at one point, joined NATO or joined the European Union, it would have been NATO and or the European Union that would have been able to respond to help those people during this invasion.
And of course, the Russian President Putin understands that and therefore is using the vulnerability of Ukraine to, as some persons, commentators state, to increase his empire or increase his territory. And it also goes to show the power of Russia. And it's a bit of a switch in terms of who really is the most powerful country or person in the world.
I think it's probably not who is more powerful in the world, because there are various countries which would claim to be a world power because they have very powerful weapons and weapons that could do tremendous damage if they were used. The United States, Britain, France, China are all very powerful nations in the world today. But the problem is that we don't want to get into a situation which is going to draw the whole world into what at present is a conflict between two particular countries. Now, I know it's very difficult to see it that way because various countries are very publicly providing military support in terms of weapons and so forth to the Ukraine. The problem is that if they directly get involved, so there's a very thin line between getting indirectly involved and directly involved. If they get directly involved, then it would be inevitable that Russian forces would be meeting, if it's NATO, NATO forces. Indeed. And that is something everybody's very worried about, that they don't want to see it escalating to that sort of level. One thing I would point out, though, is that it is in the interest of every democratic country to support the Ukraine, as Trinidad and Tobago has, at which the British High Commissioner in Trinidad and Tobago recently commented upon in a very positive way. But we have to understand that joining the vote in the UN General Assembly, as Trinidad and Tobago did, condemning the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, is in itself a powerful statement, because it's a statement that says, look, this is a democratic sovereign nation just like us, and we will not accept that a country can simply sidestep that sovereignty, sidestep those freedoms, because we wouldn't want it done to us.
Indeed. And let's switch the discussion to the UK in terms of sanctions against, let's say, oligarchs of or alliances of Putin. Now, there's an interesting story which had developed where Chelsea Club, basically the owner, is a Russian oligarch, and therefore sanctions will have been imposed on him, and thereby affecting the club itself, where they closed their doors at some point in time. I was also looking at a discussion whereby they were now allowed to play games without selling tickets, etc. Now, what is the legal basis for that? Can that be a legal challenge somewhere by Chelsea?
I'm sure. Well, within the domestic law in any country, there are always the possibility of challenges, legal challenges. I am sure that, the Abramovich may very well have said, well, look, let me talk to my lawyers about this. He has lawyers in England who've represented him before. And that may be something he's looking at. We just don't know. But what I would say to you is this. Sanctions or actions at a time of national security or heightened national security is not uncommon. Every sovereign state, whether it's the United Kingdom or Trinidad and Tobago as a sovereign state since 1956-62, has the right to protect itself. It has the right to protect itself from enemies, both foreign and domestic. And in many respects, it must be remembered that the first duty of a sovereign democratic state is the protection of its people. If that means that steps must be taken to control foreign money, which is acquired or could be used to harm another sovereign state, then it's the duty to look at the options that are available and to, if they can, take steps to stop that money being used or to make it more difficult for that money to be used to oppress another people. Yes. You may remember that in Trinidad and Tobago, fortunately, has never had to deal with a foreign invader, but did have its own domestic difficulty with a domestic enemy in 1990, where an attempt was made to overthrow the government. It would have been perfectly legitimate at that time for the government to take steps, had that siege continued far longer than it did, to ensure that any monies available for those who were funding the insurgents was stifled and frozen. And that could have been an option it would have taken in self-defense.
Yes. And therefore, of course, as you said, that's domestic law, and they have to protect the interest of their citizens, as well as ensuring that money laundering, that's another situation, does not occur as a result of.
Absolutely. And in fact, you use the phrase money laundering. We have, there is money laundering, which is often camouflaged in and amongst legitimate monies, legitimate ventures. You've heard the classic example of the front, the business which is a front but actually is being used for something else. But again, trying to sort of contextualize it for Trinidad and Tobago, we know, for example, that Russia has a very strong relationship, it would seem, with Venezuela, which is very close by to Trinidad and Tobago. One of the major problems with Trinidad and Tobago and Venezuela right now is in relation to people trafficking and, to an extent, gun running.
Yes.
There have been many, many complaints locally. It's been in the news about where all of these guns that flood into Trinidad and Tobago are coming from. And when you step back and consider the closeness, the geographical closeness of Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago, and the fact that there is a very strong military relationship between Russia and Venezuela, it's a very, very easy thing to see how guns that get to Venezuela or are shipped into Venezuela as part of any trade agreement between Venezuela and a foreign country could end up in Trinidad and Tobago. And so in terms of money laundering and proceeds of crime, it could be open to Trinidad and Tobago to look at that relationship to determine whether and how it might take steps in relation to Venezuela to protect itself from guns coming into the country. But these are all options that a sovereign state can look at.
Yes.
Doesn't have to. There may be good reasons for not doing so. They may not have the evidence for it. But there are steps available if they wanted to take them.
And I think that that discussion could be another episode, of course, with respect to money laundering and the drug and illegal trafficking trade. But QC, we are out of time. I just want to get your closing remarks in terms of your thoughts. How moving forward, where do you see this going?
Well, at the moment, Rondell, I, like everybody else, both as a person living in England and also a citizen of Trinidad and Tobago, we are very, very concerned with what is happening. We would like to see this conflict stop. The very recent report, only this morning, that a area that was marked children, written in Russian, has been destroyed. I think it was a theater. We don't know what the casualty list from that is, if any. But if this continues in the very near future, I think that the rest of the world is going to have to consider whether it can simply stand by and watch this destruction continue, or whether there is a red line that NATO, the United States, Canada, Britain, the United Nations has to say, it's gone too far now. We cannot allow it to go any further. And it may be that the sooner we decide where that red line is, the sooner we might have a clearer perspective of when this conflict will end.
Indeed. And true words, Anand, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here once again virtually. The discussion was indeed interesting and indeed enlightening. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Take care, Ronald.
And do be safe and do have a blessed day. So guys, it's a wrap. You have been watching Strictly Legal on WESN Content Capital. I am your host, Rondell Donald Tinyat Law. You were viewing Anand Biharilal, Queen's Counsel of No. 2 Bedford Row in London, UK. Of course, you can stream us, WESNCC, and our podcast, Strictly Legal with Rondell Donald. Before I leave, I just want to leave you with this quote. Be true to your work, your world, and your friend. Have a good day. God bless.